Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author Sheila Dane, who has just published a great children's book, Fairy Hunters, Inc. And Inc. is spelt I-N-K, and I do plan on asking her about that. Good afternoon, Sheila, and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
It is our pleasure. Maybe we could start with a little background. Who is Sheila Dane?
Sheila Dane is a farm girl from Southern Virginia who happened to grow up and move as far as Charlottesville, and then one day decided to write a children's book, and it's been all uphill from there, or downhill.
What was your previous background, if we will? You know, are you a rocket scientist?
Oh, goodness, no. I graduated from the University of Virginia with a degree in English, so I've always been in love with literature, and I read voraciously as a child. I have always read. There are books in every room of my house, as a matter of fact, including the bathroom.
The bathroom's a great place to keep books.
I think so.
What made you decide to become an author? Was it a spur of the moment thing, or you know, something you wanted to do for some considerable time?
When I was a child, I used to sit in an apple tree out behind my parents' house and try to write poems. So the urge to write has been with me for a very, very long time, but I never did anything with it. Until I went, when I was studying English at the university, I wrote a lot, because that's what you do as an English major, and you write a lot. And I got tutored by one of my TAs who told me I had some native ability, and I started writing some then, but not fiction. And it wasn't until after, I'm remarried now, but I was married previously to a man who died of cancer in 2001, and I was such a basket case from having gone through 3 years of his being ill and then his death and the aftermath of that, that the only thing I could do was be around children. And I babysat children for about a year after that. And in the process of doing that, met a little girl named Ashley, who was in the book. And I was so impressed with her. She's one of the bravest little girls I've ever met. She's about 5 years old, and she rode horses, she swam, she did gymnastics, she was a ballerina. I mean, she did everything, and I was so smitten with her and absolutely in love with her that I decided I would write a book for her, and I did. I wrote the book for Ashley. And she got me through a very difficult time in my life, because that book sort of got me through the worst part of the grief of my husband dying. So it was, you know, it's kind of ironic that such a happy kind of book came about as a result of such a sad time in my life, but that's just the way it happened.
Is Ashley still part of your life?
No, not now. Her mother did receive a copy of my book, and I think they liked it very much, but I don't see Ashley anymore, which might change one of these days when she's a little older. You know, I don't know what she thought of the book. And I hope to see her again, because she's a very special little girl, and I'm sure she will grow up to be a very special young woman.
Rose Sorba, and I do hope I pronounced that correctly, is your co-conspirator. She adds the illustrations. How did that collaboration come about?
Entirely fortuitously. I didn't know that most publishers choose the illustrator for people's books. I was utterly ignorant of that fact, and I thought that I had to find somebody to illustrate the book. And I was just beginning my search for an illustrator and kind of casting around, asking people if they knew anybody and trying to find a source of illustrators. And I met somebody who took a look at the book and said, "You need to meet Rose Sorba, because I think you two would have a lot in common." And he introduced us, and I saw her work, and her work tends to be very dark. She's had a difficult life, and her work reflects that. It's very intense and very intricate and very fantasy-driven, most of her work. And I liked it a whole lot, liked it very much. And I asked her just if she would consider doing a children's book, and she said yes, and it was the first children's book she had ever illustrated, too. And so it was really a leap of faith on my part and on her part that we could make this happen. And as she churned out the pictures, I was more and more in love with her work. And she had done just a fabulous job of making the characters. I couldn't begin to tell you what the fairies looked like until Rose put them down on paper. And then I saw, of course, that's what they look like. How could they look anything else but what they are? And she could see them.
That is just amazing. For some reason, I had assumed that you and Rose were, you know, friends from kindergarten or something.
No, I wish we had been friends from kindergarten. She's an interesting woman. She's very artistic in all her doings. She's one of these people who is driven to create. I think it gives her, it's her whole purpose of being. I think I can honestly say that. And she is driven to create things. She does puppets, and she does sculptural works, and she has writing and literature in some of her works, and does just fantastical, wonderful stuff. And there's even a building downtown on the mall in Charlottesville that has a papier-mâché tree that looks like something out of Tolkien that she built. It's got little nooks and crannies in it, and the branches run along the ceiling and on the floor, and it's magical, and that's Rose. She's just magical.
As soon as I started to read Fairy Hunters and saw the great text and great illustrations that went along with it, I was reminded, or I was taken back four decades, that there was a book that came out in 1979. It was written by a gentleman by the name of Kit Williams, and it was called Masquerade. Although it was very different in subject matter, I think Fairy Hunters could reach new highs with the same treatment. It needs to be hardcover. We need glossy, high white index paper and an elaborate page border around every page. Both the text and the wonderful illustrations would take on a whole new dimension.
I'm actually in agreement with you, and we're working on the second book right now, and she's talking about doing some of that, you know, making borders around the pages, and I want the next book to be a hardback book. The first one would have been. I self-published it, and I didn't have very much money to do that with, so I did what I could. But the second book, we're beginning to talk about what we're going to do for the illustrations, and she wants to make borders around the pages and connect the pages and do all kinds of fantastical stuff that we didn't do in the first one, and she's more engaged in the process. I think she didn't fully grasp what we were doing together. I don't think either one of us fully grasped what we were doing together until after the book had been published. And so we're going to correct all those things in the second book and have a lot of fun doing it.
Oh, and by the way, if you hear banging and crashing in the background, I'm in Mississippi, and right now we're being visited by the Thunder and Lightning Fairies.
Ah, the Thunder and Lightning Fairies. Yes, they're big in the world. Everybody should...
Oh, there goes one now. What sort of feedback are you getting about Fairy Hunters?
Well, so far, everybody who has reviewed it has loved it. We've gotten very little criticism on it, and mostly the reviews have been rave reviews. We're averaging 4.5 out of 5 reviews, 5 stars on Amazon.com, and everybody has had positive things to say about it, and some people have been positively glowing, and my mother-in-law wants to know why I don't have a big head. and all I can say is that, well, I'm not sure I can repeat this, you know. Maybe I'm just like a one-person book. I mean, a one-book person. But my husband has a lot of confidence in me. My mother-in-law has a lot of confidence in me. So I'm trudging forward, and I am doing it again. I'm determined to do it again.
I was talking to a Canadian author. This was a couple of months ago. And he came out with the interesting statement that everyone has a book in them, but only an author has a second one.
That's fabulous. I love that. I love that. Yeah. Maybe that's the difference between a regular person and an author. And I know I've had other stories in me. I have written 5 or 6 short stories for children, and I've got a storyboard for an ABC book for children, and poems that I've written for children, and some satirical poetry that I've written for adults that eventually I'm going to compile in a book and print. And also, I have a book of fairies and gremlins for adults. That needs to be written, yes. Every adult has many, many, many gremlins in their life. You know, I could mention the computer gremlin, the automobile gremlin. Let's see, what else is there? The gremlin of unfinished work. I mean, they're all just, the possibilities are endless. The dishwasher gremlin.
Well, actually, I can tell you a new gremlin. 20 minutes before we went on air, I discovered the power gremlin. All of the power went off in the house for about 5 seconds. You know, well, as a result of the thunder and lightning fairies. And so now, suddenly, I've got to reboot all the computers and, you know, keep my fingers crossed that the internet's still going to be up.
Wow, so the gremlins were kind to you today.
They were. I mean, they were friendly gremlins. Okay, an all-important question. Where can people buy Fairy Hunters, Inc.? Do you have a website? Is it on Amazon or where?
It is on Amazon.com, and it is on my website, www.fairyhunters.net, and it can be found in an ebook form on lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. But the best place to buy it, we're going to be putting it on sale on my website, and that's probably the best place to find it. right now. I'm working on getting a distributor so that Barnes & Nobles and Borders and all those places can carry it. Barnes & Nobles has expressed some interest in the book and will be carrying it once I can get it into the distributor's hands. So that's the way you find my book.
Okay. I like the concept that there are many different types of fairy. My wife laughed when I told her about your sock fairy. We obviously have a lot of them in Mississippi. What can you tell us about the sock fairy?
Well, the sock fairy lives in your socks. They're not random about how they take their socks. They take the very attractive socks and the nice ones. And they also take socks that have holes in them because they like to have an extra door to come in and out. And they live in your sock, and I don't think they'd be so nasty as to actually eat a hole in your sock, to make a hole in your sock. I think they take the ones that already have holes in them. But you should be content if you can't find your sock because you know that there's a fairy living in your house.
As I understand it, they particularly like the washing machine. You put two socks in, and only one sock comes back out.
That's right. That's where they find them. Or they sometimes find them in your laundry bag, too. That's a favorite place to find them. And they have little pillows of sock lint that they sleep on. They play... They do. And they play games. If I'm not mistaken, sock fairies who play games. And so be grateful for your sock fairies. It's
okay,
all the mysteries.
There was another fairy that left me chuckling, the pocket fairy.
The pocket fairy. He lives in your pocket and has all kinds of things that he plays with, bits of string and coins. And of course, the favorite thing that he has is chocolate kisses, which they use as a kind of chocolate milkshake. And of course, you only discover this when you put your hand in your pocket and you hit the gooey chocolate. So sometimes it's not very much fun to know that you have a pocket fairy, but they live there unless your pocket gets a hole in it and it falls out. So it's a very good idea to keep your pocket sewn up so that the pocket fairy doesn't fall out.
So all of that squishy chocolate, it has nothing to do with the chocolate just being in the pocket. It's everything to do with the fairy.
That's right. That's right. They find chocolate.
I am by no means a traditional reviewer. I hold views that are likely contrary to most people. I actually believe that writing a children's book is much harder than banging out some adult-oriented adventure or mystery stories. There are different dynamics at work. Number one, your reader likely is not the purchaser. The person paying the money is a parent. And parents look at books and they're always looking for some learning potential. The child, on the other hand, is looking for the entertainment value. You know, mummy, buy me this. This looks so neat. And then we have the readability issue, which you have to appeal to both the parents and the children. You've got to make it fun, and you've somehow got to appeal to the adults. How difficult is it to strike that balance?
Well, I think I'm one of the blessed people in the world because I do it naturally. I've always loved words. I've read voraciously since I was a child, and my house is full of books, and I still read children's books voraciously. And so to me, it's a matter of not talking down to the child, that children can understand things that we don't think they understand, and that sometimes they can grasp from the context of what you're writing what the situation is. And so I don't believe in using short, childlike words for talking to children. I don't do that when I'm talking with them in real life, so I don't do that when I'm writing. And it works for me because I do explain some of the words that I use that I think they won't be familiar with. And I do that in a way that's often funny, which is another way to appeal to the child. And for me, it's just a natural extension of the way that I view children, because I respect children very much. I like them and respect them and respect their abilities. And I think it's very easy to not fully give a child credit for what they do know, because they're very observant.
Indeed, and they're like sponges.
Yes, you know, they are.
Yes, if you introduce an idea, they may not immediately grab it, but they'll put it away, and it'll come back a couple of days later, and away you go.
Uh-huh, and you may not know what kind of form it's going to take when it comes back, but it will come back, yes.
I spent, something like 6.5 years working in adult education. It was essentially working with the homeless and working poor, computer-related stuff. And one of the things that I noticed was a very low literacy level, and we're talking adults. Your book actually has some quite complex words in it, but I love the way that you use your words. It's almost like a walking dictionary. You do a great job of introducing a word or a concept and then explaining it in very plain English. Was this an intentional thing, or it just evolved?
It just evolved, more or less. And then some of it I did on purpose because there were words that I knew the child would be unfamiliar with. But mostly it evolved out of my love of words, because I love word plays. And I think that's obvious in the book, because I use a lot of plays on words, which I think helps make it interesting and helps make it something that will hold a child's attention. So it evolved. It's just me.
You can probably tell from my accent that North America is not where I was born. You use words like treacle, and treacle is not a substance that you readily see over here. Do you have some British heritage or something?
No, I read voraciously people like Lewis Carroll and Rudyard Kipling, and I read a lot of non-American children's books when I was growing up, and I soak these things up like a sponge, and then they come out in these unexpected ways, And I think that's because I was influenced so heavily by British writers. So that's where that comes from.
Fairy Hunters is self-published. Did you try the traditional route first?
I did. I had an agent, and the agent tried her best to place the book. And I don't know whether it was because the book doesn't fit traditionally in. It's a chapter book, but it's also a picture book, and that's an unusual combination of events in the world of publishing. They like it to be neatly categorized in one form or another. And it wasn't. And so she had a hard time selling it, and I finally decided that I believed in it enough that I would go ahead and find a publisher on my own. And I did that. I found a printer on my own. You know, there were a lot of things I did that I could have done better, and things that next time I'll do differently. It was a very full learning experience for me, and I'm not sorry that I did it, because I really do think the book deserves to be read. And that actually has taken me 3 years. It's taken me 3 years to get to the point where I can say that I really believe the book needs an audience, deserves an audience. And because my self-confidence was so low about the whole thing, so I'm in a better place now.
Self-publishing and the traditional route have their pros and cons, but the result is the same. And I have to admit that I get a bit of a chuckle. I probably talk to well over 100 authors a year, and there is a good percentage of them that thought the hard bit was writing the book. I call it the "if you build it, they will come" syndrome.
Nah.
But the hard work is selling the book. I mean, last year, something like 300,000 new titles hit the market in the U.S. alone. What can an author do to promote their work? What are you doing?
Well, I have called schools and libraries, so I'm going to be doing readings and book signings at schools and libraries. Those are the big things that that I'll be doing. And I've been going to fairs and festivals and art shows and showing the book as an artistic endeavor, and selling the prints from the book as well. I'm getting on various radio shows like this one. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. And I am going to the Boulogne Book Festival in March, which is the world's biggest children's book fair in the world. And they have a lot of film people there. I think the book will make a fabulous film, and so I'm going to try to find somebody who will be interested in the film rights for the book, because I think it would be hysterically funny.
Oh, indeed it would. I think it would translate very well to the silver screen, and it's clever enough to be humorous to adults and children alike. You know,
yes.
Everyone has some magic in them. They just need to find it.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that. I believe that with all my heart. And every day is meant to be a day with magic. Every single day. That's how I live my life.
You mentioned earlier that there is going to be a next episode. Can you give us any inkling about when it's going to happen? Are you going to have the same characters?
Well, the same characters will be there, but I'm adding some characters. I'm adding Squirrel. Squirrel is a bit flighty, and he can never remember where he buried his nuts. So he's a bit confused a lot. And he comes to live in the big oak tree that's beside Big Rabbit's house, which upsets Big Rabbit to no end, because, as he says, it's his tree, not Squirrel's tree, and Squirrel says it belongs to everybody. So we have a little boundary and land dispute going on with Squirrel and Big Rabbit. And then we have Winnie the Poodle, who is a 4.5-pound poodle who comes to live at Ashley's house, and her parents tell her that she can help take care of him until she's old enough to take care of him by herself. And Winnie the Poodle can talk. And everybody, including Law, is really amazed because nobody's ever seen a talking poodle. And the poodle is like, well, if a rabbit can talk, why can't a poodle talk? And, of course, everybody thinks, well, that makes pretty good sense. Of course a poodle could talk. And then there's going to be John Michael, a little boy who moves in next door in the big house next to Ashley, and they have many adventures together. He's a little blonde cherub of a child, and I actually just met him. He's a person that I met in real life, and John Michael came about as a result of meeting this child, and he's 4 years old, and he bought the book, and they loved it. They read it together, his mother and he loved it. And he's very precocious, very verbal, and absolutely angelic little boy who is going to grow up to be a very smart young man, I think. And I was so impressed with him, I decided right on the spot that John Michael had to be in the book. And I thought that was good.
Oh, well, it sounds splendid. When is it going to hit the presses?
Well, we're trying to get it out by Christmas, which means I'm going to have to write like mad, and Rose is going to have to illustrate like mad, but we're trying for Christmas. It may be a little after Christmas, but we're trying for Christmas.
Alas, our time is up, but I do want to thank you for coming on the show today. And I also want to wish you every success with Fairy Hunters, Inc. Oh, one last question. INK.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why INK rather than INC.
INK. Well, Ashley knows that her father goes off to a business to work every day, and he calls it an ink. But she can't spell ink because she doesn't know it's incorporated, and her only spelling of ink is I-N-K. So, of course, it's Fairy Hunters, I-N-K.
But by the way, listeners, that is in the book, but I just wanted to ask the question. Sheila, thank you so much for taking part this afternoon. I wish you every success in the future, and maybe one day we will talk again when your next book comes out.
I would like that very much, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be on your show, Simon.
Okay, have a wonderful day. This is Simon Barrett from www.bloggernews.net, wishing everyone a great day. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.
Simon?